From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. And this morning we speak with Laura Lindenfeld. She's the executive director of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. She joins our program to share what improv and science have in common and the remarkable work they're doing to empower scientists to better communicate with the rest of us. Then in the second half, our very own Friday night DJ and surround sound expert, Mike Wisland. He'll talk about the life of a true local legend, Emmy Award winner, and surround sound pioneer, Jim Fosgate. These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Science and technology affect all of us every single day. But how much of this complex world do we, the non-technical public, truly understand? This complexity isn't just from computers, AI, and the latest from NASA. We are all affected by science in our everyday lives, like staying healthy, the way we travel, and the food we eat. And thanks to the work of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science, we have the tools and resources to understand and even trust this information. Here to tell us more about the Alda Center and their science communication programs and training is the Alda Center Executive Director, Laura Lindenfeld. Laura, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
It's really cool to be on Cool Science Radio. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, I know a lot of people aren't familiar with the center, so let's start by tell us about the Alda Center and the wonderful programs you offer.
Yeah, maybe I'll go back and tell you how the center started, because it was an aha moment of our wonderful actor, director, writer, Alan Alda. So Alan Alda was shooting Scientific American Frontiers. He did that for PBS for 11 years, went all over the world, and he would engage with scientists, and he would notice when he could make eye contact with them and really create a relationship, he was able to pull these remarkable stories and really effective communication out of people. And there's one particular incident I've heard him talk about where it happened to be a woman he was interviewing, and he noticed that she would remember the camera and do this, you know, if you could see me, look at the camera and freeze. And it's like the white lab coat went on, and he thought, wow, what's going to happen if I'm not here to bring her back? And he was able to bring her back and get her relating and conversing again. And he thought, oh, the only training I had as a young actor was improv. What if we did improv with scientists? So in inimitable Alan Alda fashion, he went around the greater New York City metro area and out here on Long Island and Stony Brook, our dynamic campus where the Alda Center is hosted, put its hand up and said, we'll give that a try. So that was, I think, 2009, the center was founded. And I took over as director in 2016. And I have the great, tremendous joy of working with an incredible team to help scientists across the U.S. and the globe learn to be better communicators.
Well, and like, it's interesting that you say improv, because I think scientists work in their world and the public, we exist in ours, and there can be this massive gap in between. And so often when you talk to somebody, especially like us on Cool Science Radio, it's a lot of improv and engaging these scientists and these physicists. And so to teach, how do you teach these scientists to engage and even improv with the public?
So first of all, when we say improv, you should see, you know, a science communication expert walks into a room of physicists and says, we're going to do improv. Can you imagine? Like, everybody's like, oh, really? We're not talking about stand-up comedy. We're talking about learning how to relate and connect as human beings. So I always have to remind myself, as you know yourself, there's many publics. It's not one general public. Scientists are part of public audiences as well. So big part of what we do in improv is remind people your work is important, and we want to help you make connections with people who might care more and be more curious if they feel like they can trust you and relate to you. So we use, you walk into a room and we carefully scaffold, you know, it's very thoughtfully designed and research-based what we do, but we use improvisational theater exercises to help scientists make connections, read the room, understand how they're coming across. Am I relevant? Do people care? Are they falling asleep? So it's very dynamic. It always starts with improv, and then we walk back and say, well, what was that experience like? And what does that have to do with communication? Why did we just do that? And how can you use this principle?
Isn't it interesting, Laura, that it always comes back to ability to communicate? And it's interesting to me that, and I'm wondering how this is evolving at American institutions and universities that are are they adding in a class on how to communicate? And I'm sure that you all at the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science have had a big role in saying, hey, wait a minute, one of the problems here is there's all this great research and there's these incredible, brilliant minds in science who just can't communicate it. And it is a big problem. It's what, you know, it's what we always hope to overcome on this show for the last decade, you know, trying to bring the science to the layperson. So what is the hand that you've had in working with other universities across the country?
I have about a million answers to this question, so I'm going to try one on you, and then you can dig in any further and we can improvise as we as humans do. I think, you know, Alan being such a household name and a trusted source, when Alan stood up and said, we're going to do this, and he gave talks all over the country. I mean, I've been internationally, I've traveled with him as well. I think it really had a resounding impact. And a lot of universities said, I think we need to do that. We need to care about how publics engage with science, because ultimately as voters, we make decisions about where funding goes, and we make decisions about how science enters policy or not. And I think this started to take shape. And you've seen, you're absolutely right, a proliferation, which I think is wonderful, of science communication training programs and courses across institutions of higher ed in the United States. When we train, we work with nonprofits like universities and other NGOs and organizations, corporations, national labs, federal agencies, any organization where scientists, and I mean STEM professionals, science, technology, engineering, and math, work, we want to improve their communication abilities. And I'm just thrilled there's other organizations out here that do this work as well in the US and abroad, and a growing body of scholarship that investigates how we can do this better.
And Laura, I'm wondering what your background is. Is it in communications? Is it in science? Is it a hybrid?
Well, the short version is I did a PhD in cultural studies at UC Davis. And, you know, the word communication comes from the word community. And I really think culture and communication are linked hand in glove. So I wound up coming into communication because a lot of the work I did in cultural studies was about how we communicate and make meaning together. I actually came to science communication because I worked in environmental issues and food. And I like to say that if you study food long enough, you find your way to the earth. And if you're looking at what's happening with the earth, you wind up thinking about science. So I came into this as someone curious about science, married to a biomedical geneticist, but not a skilled scientist. I'm a social scientist. So how's that for an answer?
Well, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Laura Lindenfeld, the Alda Center for Communicating Science Executive Director. Well, when we think science, I think a lot of us think the traditional science, biology, computers, technology. But on your website, you were talking about how you work with you talk about the literacy of food and travel. What areas of science do you guys really work with?
Yeah, I mean, here's what we do. We help experts take what they know really, really, really well and get over their curse of knowledge. Maybe I should unpack that for you. Yeah. What's a curse of knowledge? It's a wonderful thing. I work at a knowledge production factory, otherwise known as a university. I mean, it's our job to create new knowledge. What that means is when you know something really, really well, it's so easy to lose sight of the fact that the people you're trying to reach aren't with you. So then you're cursed by that knowledge because you forget what it feels like not to know what you know. So to me, it's not totally irrelevant. I don't want to say that. What kind of science you're communicating about, there's really different perceptions that audiences have. For us, it's really about helping you overcome that perception and understand that when you're communicating about your work and the work of others in the scientific community, you bear a certain level of responsibility for making sure that you demonstrate care for the people with whom you communicate and that you aim to reach them in ways where what you have to share will land so it's relevant for them. You know what? There's two principles of improv that I think I should bring up here.
Yeah.
How's that sound to you?
Please do. Okay.
So this undergirds, this is the philosophy of the Alda Center. And if you just take this at the micro level and then spin it out. So the first principle is yes, and probably heard this before. That doesn't mean you accept someone else's opinion and agree with it, but you accept that that's how they see the world. And rather than denigrating or, God forbid, humiliating them, if you follow this principle of yes, and, you say yes to them as a human being and make the scene go forward. So we teach that principle. How do you acknowledge you might disagree? Doesn't mean you agree, but that you respect the humanity of an experience of this other person so you can actually have conversation. And the second principle goes hand in hand with this is make your partner look good. What does it mean to demonstrate care through communication?
Well, I know that Lynn and I are continually making each other look good, hopefully.
I think you are right now.
So the focus of the Alda Center is to really communicate science. So why is scientific literacy so important to nowadays?
Yeah, I'm going to take that term literacy and I'm going to flip it a little if that's okay with you. You know, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with literacy, but I'm really concerned about engagement. And that has to do, if I could get a little wonky with you for 1 minute on this cool podcast about science.
Oh, please do.
There's this concept out there in the science communication research world, and it's called the deficit model. And it's the idea that we think we can just open people's heads and pour information and like add more information. They're going to get it. They're going to make better decisions. And that's not how it works. So to come back to why, you know, a nice cultural studies PhD like me is running a science communication center like this, it's because when we experience science, we're doing that as whole human beings embedded in our culture and society. And to me, when we think about engagement, it's about building trust so that there's an opportunity for people to hear. There's actually well-documented cases where communication can backfire and make disbelief even worse, depending on who the source is, what the content is, and how you convey it. So when we're doing our trainings, when we're designing them and running them through the center, we're paying attention to all that information so we can best prepare scientists to show up as human beings, make connections, and make sure, kind of like doctors, do no harm. Make sure that you're enabling better sense of community and flow of information. So I tend to think about this more about engagement than literacy. Literacy to me can imply I have knowledge you don't have. I'm going to give you something and I'm going to make you better. And that's why I prefer the term engagement for what we do.
I think that's great, the word engagement. And, you know, Laura, I want to ask your opinion on this because I have mused on this for a while and I think it is all about science communication. What went wrong with the way that the American public were communicated to about COVID? Because in the beginning of COVID, I thought so naively to myself, oh, finally, something that will unite our country, and look what it did instead. And I think that a lot of people don't really understand the scientific process, that you test a theory and you put it out there as a possible finding, and then it may change as you test it more and do more research. And that is, maybe we can say it's the fault of the communication and engagement, or the lack thereof, that really allowed people to understand that. Instead, they went to this place of disbelief, like you were talking about, and said, oh, we've been lied to because they said this, and now we know that's not true. So I'm just wondering if you could comment on that and what went wrong.
Yeah, I'm not going to get all of the thoughts I have into this short interview, but here's a couple of thoughts. I think we tend to think of communication as a transactional thing. I say something, you hear it, the message lands. I say to my son, take out the garbage, and the garbage doesn't go out. Why? I said it very clearly. Communication is much more relational and constitutive. That means it shapes who we are as we shape it, and we're not always aware of these forces. If you think about communication as the system that undergirds everything we do in society, it's really complex. I'm not surprised things went wrong. We're living in a time and space where, if you think about where people get their information from, they're making choices that are deeply politicized. So if you're getting information through one source that you trust in the culture you live in on a day-to-day basis, and you trust that, you're going to continue to trust it, especially if there's a polarized opposite. So we cannot think about something like COVID vaccines without understanding, you know, the evolution of social media, media industries, what people tune into, what they don't, what they disbelieve, what they don't. So I think, I wish, you know, I don't want to do over on a pandemic. Do you? I do not. I wish for us as a society that we could do our level best to help scientists become brokers of their own information and build more trust within their communities. Scientists are everywhere. Doctors are trained in science, so that we're generating more of a belief that science is one source, a really important one, that's thoughtfully vetted in a different way than any other kind of information that can help us make better decisions. That's a very tight answer on a big question. But
I know, I realize it was a big question. And I also then wonder about how we may pigeonhole the communication skills of scientists. Because, I mean, on this show, we have talked to some amazing scientists who are very, very adept at communication. And it's funny, I was thinking, they're typically scientists at NASA. I feel like at NASA, they must have some kind of good program too. Like, oh, it's you guys.
Yeah. We do a lot of work with NASA. They care about this. They recognize, not that we were, I mean, there are just some incredible communicators to begin with, but that's an investment NASA believes in.
Okay, that is really great to know. And so obviously it is so, it's so effective what you are doing at the Aldous Center for Science Communication, because what I find when talking to scientists at NASA is that their excitement and their passion is so infectious, and they talk about it so well. I, as a layperson, cannot help but think it's the coolest organization ever. And I, you know, I can't wait to go to one of the Artemis launches and, you know, all of that stuff. So, wow, kudos to you. That's great.
Well, and I do not want to suggest we've worked with everybody at NASA. There's a lot. But I think as an organization, they really believe in this. And what you just said about generating excitement, when someone can see you, say yes and make your partner look good, as a person who cares and wants to share that information with someone else in a way that's relevant to them, I think that's really powerful. I'd like to see more of that. In some ways, I'm talking about grassroots efforts that might help us overcome some of the more entrenched barriers that we face. That's not the only answer, but I think it's a really big piece of it, especially post-pandemic, where people are craving more direct interaction with each other. There's big opportunity there.
So for all of our listeners who are scientists out there, how can they better communicate science within their work programs or with their families or the general public, aside from taking some of your amazing courses?
Well, I do think training matters. I think we learn how to do things because we invest time in them. And, you know, I think we're generations back, people who poo-pooed the idea that scientists need to learn to communicate. You get trained up to communicate in a very particular way, which leads to that curse of knowledge. So find some training. Look around where you are. We do work online and in person. It's very powerful in person. There's a lot of opportunities. Practice. Pay attention. I mean, the biggest thing I would say is pay attention. Do people look interested? Are they asking questions? It's just so easy to feel like you're standing on this sage on the stage. Look out and see, do people care what you have to say? And so we tell a lot of the folks we walk in, we say, when we talk about improv, it's like what you were doing when you were having coffee this morning before we walked in the room. You were paying attention to each other and you were making connections.
So I know that most of your programs, if not all, focus on professionals, but as a general public, what steps can we take to become more engaged in the science around us? What role, what responsibilities do we have to understand what's happening?
Oh, I love this question. First of all, I think, you know, we think about great accomplishments of society, art, music, literature, science. It's one of the most amazing things we as human beings have created, and it is a creative process. There are organizations all around you, museums, civic science initiatives, universities have opportunities, podcasts just like this. There's so many beautiful journalistic outputs, books, book clubs, opportunities to learn more. And I'm just so thrilled that you have this podcast to bring this conversation to bear in your community.
Oh, sorry.
Let me just ask one final question, Laura. I'm curious, and I'm sure that, you know, it's very interesting when celebrities feel passionate about something and have a movement and you know, in the case of Alan Alda, having sort of founded this Center for Science Communication, how much involvement does he still have? And does he feel like he has set about, you know, the goal that he set about to accomplish, has he accomplished it?
I think if you asked him, he'd say he's really proud of the work that we've done. He's still really involved in the center. He's a busy guy. He runs his own podcast, Clear and Vivid, and he interviews a whole bunch of scientists on there, supported by the Kathleen Foundation. Go ahead and give that a listen if you haven't. There's some awesome interviews. It's fun to hear him at work. He comes in by Zoom occasionally and helps us work through new exercises. And he's got his chops, so gives my faculty a really good round of feedback. But he's just been an ardent supporter, spokesperson, and he's still really deeply involved in the center.
So people listening, where can they go? Sorry, let me start this one over again. So what kind of specific trainings does the Alda Center for Communicating Science offer?
Yeah, if you go to our website, aldacenter.org, you'll see all different kinds of professional development opportunities that we provide. We have workshops that we come and do at organizations in person. We have some that are online. We have coursework that you can take if you're a student at Stony Brook. We have a master's in science communication that we're really proud of. Do look this up if you're interested, specifically for people with a STEM background who want to become professional communicators. Because I think that knowledge of science and the scientific process, I think it's really important to bring that to bear when we're communicating about science. So that's where you can go and look. I'll also point out we have on our website something called The Link. For those of you who are involved in science communication, whether as a trainer, practitioner, or researcher, we started this site to connect science communication research with practice. There's a lot of knowledge out there. We've tried to boil this down and make it applicable so you don't have to read, you know, 15 social science articles a month to keep up with newest trends.
Well, for all of our listeners, go to aldiscenter.org for their amazing programs, information, such a great resource. Well, Laura Lindenfeld, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Without people like you training the scientists that we talk to, we wouldn't be able to understand.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for hosting me, and thank you for your remarkable work.
Thank you, Laura.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Katie Mullally had to step out today. The quality of sound is something that occupies the minds and even the hearts of sound engineers, but many of the rest of us just take it for granted. But there was one sound engineer, inventor, and businessman who spent his life's work on creating quality sound. Jim Fosgate was a Heber resident, a family man, an inventor, and holder of some 17 patents. He pioneered sound technology by inventing the first car stereo amplifier, and he launched an audio company in Heber and was the creator of Surround Sound. Jim passed away in December at the age of 85, and a celebration of his life will be held at Red Butte Gardens on May 21st. Joining us now to tell the story of Jim Fosgate, also known as Foz, is KPCW's own Friday night DJ and sound expert, Mike Wisland, known as Wiz. Wiz, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It's very exciting to share some really cool science from the audio perspective.
Absolutely. Well, we love to hear stories about local characters, colorful people, experts in their fields. And certainly Jim Fosgate, or Foz, I think you must just call him Foz, was one of those people. How did you first come to know about Foz?
Actually, it was a Boy Scout senior project in Heber. And he had a little demonstration and he got some of his equipment out of his museum. Foz had a museum of stuff in his basement, all things audio. And so he brought it to the Old Folks Center in Heber. My dean asked me to come up because you might know something about Jim Fosgate. And I'm like, oh, the inventor of surround sound? Yes, I think I do. But I hadn't met him yet. So they showed his little Foz documentary, Wizard of Foz is what it's called. And after that, I felt, wow, not enough people know his name at the Audio Engineering Society, of which I'm a member. And I thought, you know, I need to fix that because I work in the digital media department at Utah Valley University. So I have access to students and cameras and equipment. And I thought, well, would you mind if I came up to your house and interviewed you about all your inventions and discussed them in detail? So he allowed us to come up with cameras. And so we filmed a lot of his inventions, discussed it, and had a really good time. And I did that over a period of 13 years, believe it or not, just on and off. And then he kept on inventing things. So I had to keep going up there and keeping up with him.
Right. How can people find these documentaries if they're interested, if they know something about Jim Fosgate, or if they're just interested in a colorful person?
There is online a group called the Friends of Fosgate, or Friends of Foz. But we are going, I know that the Foz video that was, he paid for that to be created. I'm going to ask the family if we can put that out on YouTube. I don't think they're going to object to that. So I'll discuss that with the memoriam on the 21st, like you said, of May. And then after that, I think we'll probably put my documentary is not really what I would call a documentary film. They're sort of little shorts about his various inventions, because my idea was to get him a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Audio Engineering Society. He got an Emmy Award for his work in surround sound and allowing our homes to be full of 5.1 channels of wonderful sound. So I thought that the Audio Engineering Society should recognize him. So that's why I was creating a series of these videos.
And did you achieve that? Did he receive that award?
Not yet. I was working on that. We had not completed the documentary at the time of his passing. He got real busy towards the end because he was moving to California. And so I got all the way up to Dolby Pro Logic that he sold to Ray Dolby. And that's what made him some good money. But he did not stop inventing. So I think at age, I don't know, he never stopped really, but at age 80, he really picked up the steam and began making products for a company called Black Ice Audio. And you can go to blackiceaudio.com, I think, or you know, something, Black Ice, and find his products that he's been making in the last 5 years. In fact, his last product is a headphone amplifier, tube-based, that has a knob on it that can expand a stereo signal into a surround-like experience, experienced in headphones.
Well, so. That's so interesting. I'd love to talk a lot here about surround sound, but before we do that, let's go back to the beginning of Foz's life, where he was actually born into, his father was also a radio man, as I understand. And
TV repairman.
He was born into it, and he constructed, I love this, a little radio to mount on his bicycle handlebars, I suppose. And that was sort of the beginning. And it evolved from there. He was always involved in sound. And for you, a person also involved in sound, what is it that you think the rest of us are missing that we might not notice if we're experiencing quality sound or even surround sound?
I think the best thing to do is with the time that we have, is to explain his multi-channel inventions. He did a lot of nice stereo amps for us to listen to, and the quality increases. You hear the highs, the high frequencies, the S's are more clear, and the explosions are much lower and much bigger. In the 70s and early 80s, quadraphonic sound came out, which was an amazing thing. On a stereo record, they could stuff four channels on it. I won't get into the gory details of how they did it, but the rear channels are phase changed by 90 degrees. That's as technical as I'll get. And then those are added to the front channels to be issued as a compatible stereo signal. But if you had a decoder, which Jim invented, it would take those rear channels and throw them in the back of your living room so you could listen to your records in a quadraphonic sound. But due to format wars, quad died out in about 1982. It was pretty dead, so Jim was looking for other things to do. And he realized that movies require what they call a center channel sound that appears to be coming from the screen. And that was invented so that anybody in the theater will hear the sound, regardless if you're sitting left, right, or center in the theater. You will hear the dialogue of the actor coming from the center of the screen. So he realized he needed a center channel. And then for ever since Star Wars, the sound got a whole lot better in movie theaters. And he realized that there needed to be what they call a subwoofer channel. And that's for extremely low frequency sounds like explosions and whatnot. And so he incorporated that and designed a system. And here's where the cool science is you took all five of those channels and somehow composed them into a stereo compatible file, which can be listened on any stereo. It can be transmitted over FM stereo. It can be put on a DVD or a CD or streamed over social media, as long as it's a stereo signal. And you have Jim's decoder. It looks at that signal and actively decomposes the rear channels and puts them back where they're supposed to be, gives you the center channel back, and then puts the low frequency sound in your subwoofer, all from a stereo signal. So that's the black magic. Six channels into two.
Wow.
You transmit them any way you wish, and then you decode them at the other end.
And so even on my little AirPods here, that's something I can, that's the sound that I'm getting.
Maybe. Now there are, you can have, and I sent you some files that are actually Dolby Pro Logic 2 files. And that's what they agreed to call it, because when Jim invented this system and he called up Ray Dolby and said, well, you're the guy I'd like to deal with. I have something that you might be interested in, five channels of sound for movies. And he's like, so they flew out to Heber and they listened to his device and actually have the original prototype in my collection. He gave me some of his, he gave me all of his equipment.
Wow.
For UVU to create a museum with. We have the bicycle that he rode around town with the radio. So,
wow.
Yeah, we're going to put on a museum at UVU in the upcoming year. So, anyway, so it's interesting to know, and most people don't realize this. You must have a Dolby Pro Logic 2 receiver. In other words, a multi-channel amplifier, which is 5.1 typically.
Okay.
And once you purchase one of those and then throw five speakers around your room, one in the center of the television set, you know, or just beneath it, really, and then a left or right, and then a left in the back and a right in the back.
So let me ask you this, Wiz. And by the way, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, I'm speaking with Mike Wisland, better known as Wiz, at least here on KPCW's airwaves. He's our Friday night DJ. He's also a surround sound expert. And we're speaking about the life of Jim Fosgate, who will have a celebration of life at Red Butte Gardens this on May 21st. Oh, goodness. Is that Saturday? Sunday. And I wanted to ask you about when you're sitting now in a really high quality theater and you're watching some big action movie and suddenly you hear, you know, in back here somewhere to the right, you know, some little sound and you literally turn around to see like what is that sound? Like you hear grasshoppers or maybe some small explosion or whatever it is. Is that what Jim Fosgate created?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah,
he created that.
Wow.
It's been upgraded since his invention. It's now called Dolby Atmos. And it can have up to as many as 128 speakers in the theater.
Oh, that's incredible. Okay, I remember this during the Sundance Film Festival about 8 years ago. Dolby made a contribution to the Eccles, or to the performing arts over there at the high school, the Eccles Center.
Screen.
Yeah, the Dolby Atmos, and it was such a big deal. I remember it being, I don't know why I remember this number, it was $250,000 that they were upgrading as a donation to that facility for, you know, it happened during the Sundance Film, or I think they got it installed before the festival so that there would be better sound. So that
a couple films were screened in Dolby Atmos. I was at those screenings, so yeah, I know what you're talking about.
So that was really exciting for someone like you. And I would imagine, I mean, what did you hear from people who are also in the audience? Does it take someone who really knows about sound to pick these things out, or do the rest of us just say, wow, I don't know what that was, but that was incredible?
I think both. But when you said, I hear this sound coming from the backside of the theater, that's the obvious part of surround sound. And you know, so anyone can pick up on that. But sometimes we try not to do that as sound engineers, to distract the audience, to turn around, and we call it the exit sign effect. If you create distinct sounds that draw the attention away from somebody, they miss the movie,
yeah,
the next edit. So what the reason they call it Atmos is it creates sort of an atmospheric effect that surrounds you.
Right.
Rather than, it can be distinct sounds, like put the trumpet in the rear right and stuff like that. That was done on those quad records in the 70s. It just creates sort of a spatial sound. A good engineer, really, when he does the job, he or she properly, you truly don't notice it. You feel immersed, mm-hmm, in the film rather than watching it. You feel like you're inside of it. And that's the sign of a good design soundscape for a movie.
And that creates more of an experience than you on the outside of something.
Yeah, so that's the thing about audio engineers. When you do your job well, nobody notices.
Yeah. Isn't that funny? Okay, so I'm going to play, we have about 7 seconds, I'll play it twice, of what is the Dolby Pro Logic. It was a channel test, so you can hear all the channels.
Yes.
And now, if people are listening to this as they're driving around in their cars, what are they going to hear? Is it going to just hear?
If you only have stereo in your car, you'll hear the test, channel one, channel two. This is the left, this is the right. But folks, if you're driving around or you're listening at home and you didn't know you had a surround system in it, my car has surround.
Oh.
So you will hear that he'll call out left channel, right channel. And then when he says rear left, if you hear it coming from your back left speaker, you'll know you're listening to a surround. So this is a stereo compatible. But it will decode in surround. So go ahead and play that, and we'll test everybody's speakers out.
Okay.
Front left, front right, center, back left, back right.
So that simple test will tell you whether you have surround engaged in your...
Most cars come with that stock, like new cars?
Most premium edition of cars come with surround.
Okay, I'm going to play it one more time so that people can tune in if they...
Okay, turn up your radio, folks.
Front left, front right, center, back left, back right.
So you heard all those commands. If you heard the last two come from the rear of your room, then you are decoding in Dolby Pro Logic 2, as they call it.
That's interesting because, our headphones here at KPCW, they're probably... not the highest quality, but I could hear the left and then the right. And then the rear, it did give you a feeling that they were at the back of the headphones somehow.
Yeah, so even listening in headphones, it's a pretty unique experience.
Yeah.
Which brings up an interesting topic. You don't have to have surround encoded files to enjoy Jim's invention. You can listen to all of your stereo music, your CDs, and the system actively is looking for information that might be interesting to throw back into the rear channels. So I love to listen to Paul McCartney's Live and Let Die, and you turn on the surround, you push the surround button, and it expands that song and kind of explodes into your room and surround, even though it's only a stereo file, it wasn't meant for surround sound.
Interesting. Now, you sent me another couple of songs. Is it the Thriller, Michael Jackson's Thriller?
Yes.
And also Under Pressure by David Bowie.
Right.
These are very, everyone knows those two songs.
I tried to pick songs everyone would know.
And is it worth playing a little bit of them so that we can hear it in that same surround sound and know that it was Jim Fosgate who created this technology? Can you hear it from the beginning?
Depends on the song. But these are stereo files. They're the stereo files that everybody owns. But when you apply Jim's decoder to it, it does take the music and expand it all around you. So these are just known stereo files that are known to work really well with Dolby Pro Logic 2. So if you have that in your car, I just have it engaged all the time. And it picks up on certain instruments and puts them in the rear channel.
I feel like I've seen this little button in my car, or at least some car that I've owned that says, that you can just hit ProLogic, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So do you...
It will take your stereo files and it will expand them into surround sound, even if they're not surround files.
Okay. Well, then if you had, you know, if we have 25 seconds that we can play one of these, which would you prefer that we can hear it?
What three do you have?
I have Thriller and Under Pressure.
I would say probably, let's do Thriller.
Okay. And right from the beginning. Okay. Here we go. Okay, that is good. You've enlightened me. Hopefully that's enlightening to others out there listening. I could really feel it.
Just a reminder, you don't need surround files to enjoy Jim's technology.
Mm.
So, kind of makes listening to all of your music a little more exciting.
Yes. Jim Fosgate, what an extraordinary human. Also, at some point in his life, he got really involved in model airplanes, and he has a deep connection to the Heber Airport. Tell us about that.
As an engineer, he realized that, you know, as an RC model, you know, they fly the little airplanes around the airport, and he realized that you get two or three people out there at the airport and you're crashing each other's airplanes because they interfere with each other. So he invented a radio system that was able to handle five or six airplanes at one time. And it wasn't just changing the frequency. He just had a very good, tight system that would reject all interference. So his RC controllers for model airplanes were known to be the best.
Mm.
That's how he kind of changed that industry.
So on the controller, would you have the ability to just switch between the airplanes, or were they all being controlled by one channel?
Oh, you would have your own little frequency. Everyone would agree to have the different frequencies. But the key thing with Fosgate's equipment is with cheaper equipment, all those frequencies would get jumbled and interfere with each other, and you'd be crashing planes. And so, but with Jim's system, it was, you could have five, six, seven people out there running, and they would have no problem. So he was very famous in that, in that group of people for his equipment.
Right. And I read that he made some donation to the Heber Airport as well, creating, maybe it was a runway or an area of the airport that was sort of designated for the model.
RC and the model plane users. Yes, he did that. Uh-huh.
Wow. Really incredible. And so tell us a little more about his celebration of life coming up this Saturday. What time is it? And what more do folks need to know other than it's taking place at Red Butte Gardens?
Yeah. It's the 21st. It'll be at 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. And it'll be a very casual event, you know, just kind of. And then there'll be a few people that speak about Jim kind of educate them about what he did and his life. I'll be there, of course. I won't be speaking, but the family members will. And that'll be kind of a fun little event. Also, it's worthy of mentioning that a lot of his lively goods of his life that he gathered over his life are going up for sale at his estate sale today through Saturday. And since all of it goes to his 501c foundation, it's the Jim and Norma Fosgate Foundation, which donates to a lot of different charities, children in Africa, for example, etc. Mm-hmm. So all that money goes to the foundation today from all the artifacts that were left over in his house.
Wow. Is this an online estate sale or is it taking place in the Heber Valley?
You might see the objects online, but they're available physically at his home, which, you know, you'd get a tour of his home if you'd like. I can give you that address, in fact.
Please do.
It's 4750 East, 1200 South in Heber. Now that 1200 South is, if you're coming up through Provo Canyon and you hit the stoplight in Heber, you just keep going straight for 3 or 4 miles till you hit 4750 East.
Okay.
And it's on the right-hand side. It's kind of buried in a lot of scrub oak. You can barely see it. And I'm sure there'll be balloons and signs out front. But that sale starts here in an hour.
Well, for audiophiles near and far, that would be an incredible opportunity. And Wiz, we're so glad that you could join us today on Cool Science Radio. It's so fascinating to learn about this local legend and also to know about that his work continues and it will endure in perpetuity. And so Celebration of Life coming up 11 a.m. on Saturday at Red Butte Gardens. And thank you for your time, Wiz.
Indeed.
All right, take care. And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.